Roger agreed, which probably meant he'd been smoking glass, but what the fuck. Get down here to town. Meet me and Fern at the motor pool. We're gonna take two of them big trucks, the ones with the hoists, out there to WCIK. All the propane's got to be moved back to town. We can't do it in one day, but Jim says we gotta make a start. Tomorrow, I'll recruit six or seven more guys we can trust. Some of them Jim's goddamn private army, if he'll spare 'em. And we'll finish up.
Oh, Stuart, no. I got to feed these chickens. The boys I got left has all gone to be cops.
Which means, Stuart thought, you want to sit in that little office of yours smoking glass and listening to shit music and looking at lesbian makeout videos on your computer. He didn't know how you could get horny with the aroma of chicken shit so thick you could cut it with a knife. But Roger Killian managed.
This is not a volunteer mission, my brother. I got ordered and I'm ordering you 30 minutes. And if you do happen to see any of your kids hanging around, you shanghai 'em along.
He hung up before Roger could recommence his whiny shit and for a moment just stood there fuming. The last thing on earth he wanted to do with what remained of this Wednesday afternoon was muscle propane tanks into trucks. But that was what he was going to be doing, all right. Yes, he was. He snatched the spray hose from the sink, stuck it between Arletta Coombs' dentures, and triggered it. It was a high-pressure hose, and the corpse jumped on the table.
"Wash them crackers down, Grandma," he snarled. "Wouldn't want you to choke."
"Stop!" Fern cried. "It'll squirt out the hole in it."
Too late.
9. Big Jim looked at Rusty with a see-what-it-gets-you smile. Then he turned to Carter and Freddie Denton.
"Did you fellows hear Mr. Everett try to coerce me?"
"We sure did," Freddie said.
"Did you hear him threaten to withhold certain life-saving medication if I refuse to step down?"
"Yeah," Carter said, and favored Rusty with a black look.
Rusty wondered how he ever could have been so stupid. It's been a long day. Chalk it up to that.
The medication in question might have been a drug called Verapamil, which that fellow with the long hair administered by IV.
Big Jim exposed his small teeth in another unpleasant smile. Verapamil. For the first time, Rusty cursed himself for not taking Big Jim's chart from its slot on the door and examining it. It would not be the last.
"What kind of crimes have we got here, do you suppose?"
Big Jim asked.
"Criminal threatening?"
"Sure, and extortion," Freddie said.
"Hell with that. It was attempted murder," Carter said.
"And who do you suppose put him up to it?"
"Barbie," Carter said, and slugged Rusty in the mouth.
Rusty had no sense of it coming, and didn't even begin to get his guard up. He staggered backward, hit one of the chairs, and fell into it sideways with his mouth bleeding.
"You got that resisting arrest," Big Jim remarked. "But it's not enough. Put him on the floor, fellows. I want him on the floor."
Rusty tried to run, but barely got out of the chair before Carter grabbed one of his arms and spun him around. Freddie put a foot behind his legs. Carter pushed. Like kids in the schoolyard, Rusty thought, as he toppled over. Carter dropped down beside him. Rusty got in one blow. It landed on Carter's left cheek. Carter shook it off impatiently, like a man ridding himself of a troublesome fly. A moment later, he was sitting on Rusty's chest, grinning down at him. Yes, just like in the schoolyard, only with no playground monitor to break things up. He turned his head to Rennie, who was now on his feet.
"You don't want to do this," he panted.
His heart was thudding hard. He could barely get enough breath to feed it. Thibodeau was very heavy. Freddie Denton was on his knees beside the two of them. To Rusty, he looked like the ref in one of those put-up job wrestling matches.
"But I do, Everett," Big Jim said. "In fact, God bless you, I have to. Freddie, snag my cell phone. It's in his breast pocket, and I don't want it getting broken. The cotton picker stole it. You can add that to his bill when you get him to the station."
"Other people know," Rusty said.
He had never felt so helpless. And so stupid. Telling himself that he wasn't the first to underestimate James Rennie Sr. did not help.
"Other people know what you did."
"Perhaps," Big Jim said, "but who are they?" "Other friends of Dale Barbara, that's who.
The ones who started the food riot, the ones who burned down the newspaper office, the ones who set the dome going in the first place, I have no doubt. Some sort of government experiment, that's what I think. But we're not rats in a box, are we? Are we, Carter?
No.
Freddy, what are you waiting for? Freddy had been listening to Big Jim with an expression that said, "Now I get it." He took Big Jim's cell phone from Rusty's breast pocket and tossed it onto one of the sofas. Then he turned back to Rusty.
How long have you been planning it? How long have you been planning to lock us up in town so you could see what we'd do?
Freddy, listen to yourself, Rusty said.
The words came out in a wheeze. God, but Thibodeau was heavy.
That's crazy. It makes no sense. Can't you see the...
Hold his hand on the floor, Big Jim said. The left one.
Freddy did as he was ordered. Rusty tried to fight, but with Thibodeau pinning his arms, he had no leverage.
I'm sorry to do this, pal, but the people of this town have to understand we're in control of the terrorist element.
Rennie could say he was sorry all he wanted, but in the instant before he brought the heel of his shoe and all of his 230 pounds down on Rusty's clenched left hand, Rusty saw a different motive poking out the front of the second selectman's gabardine trousers. He was enjoying this, and not just in a cerebral sense. Then the heel was pressing and grinding, hard, harder, hardest. Big Jim's face was clenched with effort. Sweat stood out under his eyes. His tongue was clamped between his teeth. Don't scream, Rusty thought. It'll bring Ginny, and then she'll be in the cooking pot, too. Also, he wants you to. Don't give him the satisfaction. But when he heard the first snap from under Big Jim's heel, he did scream. He couldn't help it. There was another snap. Then a third. Big Jim stepped back, satisfied.
Get him on his feet and take him to jail. Let him visit with his friend.
Freddy was examining Rusty's hand, which was already swelling. Three of the four fingers were bent badly out of true.
Busted, he said, with great satisfaction.
Ginny appeared in the lounge doorway, her eyes huge.
What in God's name are you doing? Arresting this bastard for extortion, criminal withholding, and attempted murder,
Freddy Denton said as Carter hauled Rusty Everett to his feet.
And that's just a start. He resisted and we subdued him. Please, step aside, ma'am. You're nuts, Ginny cried. Rusty, your hand.
I'm all right, call Linda. Tell her these thugs.
He got no further. Carter seized him by the neck and ran him out the door with his head bent down. In his ear, Carter whispered,
If I was sure that old guy knew as much about doctrine as you, I'd kill you myself.
All this, in 4 days, and change, Rusty marveled, as Carter forced him down the hallway, staggering and bent almost double by the grip on his neck. His left hand was no longer a hand, only a bellowing chunk of pain below his wrist. Just 4 days and change. He wondered if the leatherheads, whatever or whoever they might be, were enjoying the show. 10. It was the late afternoon before Linda finally came across the mill's librarian. Lissa was biking back toward town along Route 117. She said she'd been talking to the sentries out of the dome, trying to glean further information about Visitor's Day.
They are not supposed to schmooze with the townies, but some will, she said. Especially if you leave the top three buttons on your blouse undone. That seems to be a real conversation starter. With the army guys, anyway. The Marines. I think I could take off all my clothes and dance the Macarena, and they still wouldn't say boo. Those boys seem immune to sex appeal.
She smiled.
Not that I'll ever be mistaken for Kate Winslet. Did you pick up any interesting gossip? Nope.
Lissa was straddling her bike and looking in at Linda through the passenger window.
They don't know squat. But they're awfully concerned about us. I was touched by that. And they're hearing as many rumors as we are. One of them asked me if it was true that over 100 people had committed suicide already. Can you get in the car with me for a minute?
Alyssa's smile broadened.
Am I being arrested?
There's
Something I want to talk to you about. Melissa put down the kickstand of her bike and got in, first moving Linda's citation clipboard and a non-functioning radar gun out of the way. Linda told her about the clandestine visit to the funeral home and what they'd found there, then about the proposed meeting at the parsonage. Melissa's response was immediate and vehement.
I'll be there. You just try to keep me away.
The radio cleared its throat then, and Stacy came on.
Unit four, break, break, break.
Linda grabbed the mic. It wasn't Rusty she was thinking of. It was the girls.
This is four, Stacy, go.
What Stacy Morgan said when she came back changed Linda's unease to outright terror.
I've got something bad to tell you, Lynn. I tell you to brace yourself, but I don't think you can brace yourself for a thing like this. Rusty's been arrested. What?
Linda nearly screamed. But only to Lissa. She didn't depress the send button on the side of the mic.
They've put him downstairs in the coop with Barbie. He's all right, but it looks to me like he's got a broken hand. He was holding it against his chest, and it was all swollen.
She lowered her voice.
It happened resisting arrest, they said. Over.
This time Linda remembered to key the mic.
I'll be right there. Tell him I'm coming. Over. I can't, Stacy said. No one's allowed down there anymore except for officers on a special list. And I'm not one of them. There's a whole basket of charges, including attempted murder and accessory to murder. Take it easy coming back to town. You won't be allowed to see him, so there's no sense wrecking your shop on the way.
Linda keyed the mic three times. Break, break, break. Then she said,
I'll see him, all right.
But she didn't. Chief Peter Randolph, looking freshly rested from his nap, met her at the top of the PD steps and told her he'd need her badge and gun. As Rusty's wife, she was also under suspicion of undermining the lawful town government and fomenting insurrection. Fine, she wanted to tell him. Arrest me. Put me downstairs with my husband. But then she thought of the girls who would be at Marta's now, waiting to be picked up, wanting to tell her all about their day at school. She also thought of the meeting at the parsonage that night. She couldn't attend that if she was in a cell, and the meeting was now more important than ever. Because if they were going to break one prisoner out tomorrow night, why not two?
Tell him I love him, Linda said,
unbuckling her belt and sliding the holster off it. She hadn't really cared for the weight of the gun anyway. Crossing the little ones on the way to school and telling the middle school kids to ditch both their cigarettes and their foul mouths, those things were more her forte.
I will convey that message, Mrs. Everett.
Has anyone looked at his hand? I heard from someone that his hand might be broken. Randolph frowned.
Who told you that?
I don't know who called me. He didn't identify himself. It was one of our guys, I think, but the reception out there on 117 isn't very good.
Randolph considered this, decided not to pursue it.
Rusty's hand is fine, he said, and our guys aren't your guys anymore. Go on home. I'm sure we'll have questions for you later.
She felt tears and fought them back. And what am I supposed to tell my girls? Am I supposed to tell them their daddy is in jail? You know Rusty's one of the good guys, you know that.
God, he was the one who diagnosed your hot gallbladder last year.
Can't help you much there, Mrs. Everett, Randolph said. His days of calling her Linda seemed to be behind him.
But I suggest you don't tell them that Daddy conspired with Dale Barbara in the murder of Brenda Perkins and Lester Coggins. The others were not sure of. Those were clearly sex crimes, and Rusty may not have known about them.
That's insane. Randolph might not have heard.
He also tried to kill Selectman Rennie by withholding vital medication. Luckily, Big Jim had the foresight to conceal a couple of officers nearby.
He shook his head.
Threatening to withhold life-saving medication from a man who's made himself sick caring for this town. That's your good guy. That's your goddamn good guy.
She was in trouble here and knew it. She left before she could make it worse. The 5 hours before the meeting at the Congo Parsonage stretched long before her. She could think of nowhere to go, nothing to do. Then she did.
11. Rusty's hand was far from fine. Even Barbie could see that. And there were three empty cells between them.
Rusty, anything I can do?
Rusty managed a smile.
Not unless you've got a couple of aspirin you can toss me. Darvis, that would be even better.
Fresh out. They didn't give you anything?
No, but the pain's down a bit. I'll survive.
This talk was a good deal braver than he actually felt. The pain was very bad, and he was about to make it worse. I've got to do something about these fingers, though. Good luck. For a wonder, none of the fingers was broken, although a bone in his hand was. It was a metacarpal, the fifth. The only thing he could do about that was tear strips from his t-shirt and use them as a splint. But first, he grasped his left index finger, which was dislocated at the proximal interphalangeal joint. In the movies, this stuff always happened fast. Fast was dramatic. Unfortunately, fast could make things worse instead of better. He applied slow, steady, increasing pressure. The pain was gruesome. He felt it all the way up to the hinges of his jaw. He could hear the finger creaking like the hinge of a door that hasn't been opened in a long time. Somewhere, both close by and in another country, he glimpsed Barbie standing at the door of his cell and watching. Then, suddenly, the finger was magically straight again and the pain was less. In that one, anyway. He sat down on the bunk, gasping like a man who has just run a race. Done? Barbie asked. Not quite. I also have to fix my fuck you finger. I may need it. Rusty grasped his second finger and began again. And again. Just when it seemed the pain could get no worse, the dislocated joint slipped back into place. Now there was just the matter of his pinky, which was sticking out as if he meant to make a toast. And I would if I could, he thought, to the most fucked up day in history. In the history of Eric Everett, at least. He began to wrap the finger. This also hurt. And for this, there was no quick fix. What'd you do? Barbie asked, then snapped his fingers twice sharply. He pointed at the ceiling, then cupped one hand to his ear. Did he actually know the coop was bugged or only suspect it? Rusty decided it didn't matter. It would be best to behave as if it were, although it was hard to believe anyone in this fumble bunch had thought of it yet. Made the mistake of trying to get Big Jim to step down, Rusty said. I've no doubt they'll add a dozen or so other charges, but basically I got jailed for telling him to quit pushing so hard, or he'd have a heart attack. This, of course, ignored the Coggins stuff. But Rusty thought that might be just as well for his continued good health. How's the food in here? Not bad, Barbie said. Rose brought me lunch. You want to watch out for the water, though. It can be a trifle salty. He forked the first two fingers of his right hand, pointed them at his eyes, then pointed at his own mouth. Watch. Rusty nodded. Tomorrow night, Barbie mouthed. I know, Rusty mouthed back. Making the exaggerated syllables caused his lips to crack open and start bleeding again. Barbie mouthed, we need a safe place. Thanks to Joe McClatchy and his friends, Rusty thought he had that part covered. 12. Andy Sanders had a seizure. It was inevitable, really. He was unused to glass and he'd been smoking a lot of it. He was in the WCIK studio, listening to the Our Daily Bread Symphony soar through How Great Thou Art, and conducting along with it. He saw himself flying down eternal violin strings. Chef was somewhere with the bong, but he'd left Andy a supply of fat hybrid cigarettes he called Fry Daddies.
You want to be careful with these, Sanders, he said. They are dynamite. For thee not used to drinking must be gentle. First Timothy. It also applies to fries.
Andy nodded solemnly, but smoked like a demon once Chef was gone. Two of the daddies, one after the other. He puffed until they were nothing but hot nubs that burned his fingers. The roasting cat pee smell of the glass was already rising to the top of his aromatherapy hit parade. He was halfway through the third daddy, and still conducting like Leonard Bernstein, when he sucked in a particularly deep lungful, and instantly blacked out. He fell to the floor, and lay twitching in a river of sacred music. Spit foam oozed between his clenched teeth. His half-open eyes rolled around in their sockets, seeing things that weren't there. At least, not yet. 10 minutes later, he was awake again, and lively enough to go flying along the path between the studio and the long red supply building out back.
Chef! He bawled. Chef, where are you? They're coming!
Chef Bushy stepped from the supply building's side door. His hair stood up from his head in greasy quills. He was dressed in a filthy pair of pajama pants, P pea-stained at the crotch, and grass-stained at the bottoms. Printed with cartoon frogs saying ribbit, they hung precariously from the bony flanges of his hips, displaying a fluff of pubic hair in front and the crack of his ass in back. He had his AK-47 in one hand. On the stock he had carefully painted the words God's Warrior. The garage door opener was in his other hand. He put God's Warrior down, but not God's door opener. He grasped Andy's shoulders and gave him a smart shake.
Stop it, Sanders, you're hysterical.
They're coming, the bitter men, just like you said.
Chef considered this.
Did someone call and give you a heads up?
No, it was a vision.
I blacked out and had a vision.
Chef's eyes widened. Suspicion gave way to respect. He looked from Andy to Little Bitch Road and then back to Andy again.
What did you see? How many? Is it all of them, or just a few, like before?
I...
Chef shook him again, but much more gently this time.
Calm down, Sanders. You're in the Lord's army now, and...
A Christian soldier.
Right. And I'm your superior, so report.
They're coming in two trucks.
Only two?
Yes.
Orange?
Yes.
Chef hitched up his PJs. They subsided to their former position almost immediately, and nodded.
Town trucks. Probably those same three dumbwits. The Bowies and Mr. Chicken.
Mr.
Killian, Sanders, who else? He smokes the glass, but doesn't understand the purpose of the glass. He's a fool.
They're coming for more propane.
Should we hide, just hide, and let them take it?
That's what I did before. But not this time. I'm done hiding and letting people take things. Star Wormwood has blazed. It's time for men of God to hoist their flag. Are you with me?
And Andy, who under the dome had lost everything that had ever meant anything to him, did not hesitate.
Yes.
To the end, Sanders?
To the end.
Whereat did you put your gun?
As best as Andy could recollect, it was in the studio, leaning against the poster of Pat Robertson with his arm around the late Lester Coggins.
Let's get it,
Chef said, picking up God's Warrior and checking the clip.
And from now on, you carry it with you. Have you got that?
Okay.
Box of ammo in there?
Yep.
Andy had toted one of these crates in just an hour ago. At least he thought it had been an hour ago. Fry Daddy's had a way of bending time at the edges.
Just a minute, Chef said.
He went down the side of the supply building to the box of Chinese grenades and brought back three. He gave two to Andy and told him to put them in his pockets. Chef hung the third grenade from the muzzle of God's Warrior by the pull ring.
Sanders, I was told that you get 7 seconds after you yank the pin to get rid of these cocksuckers. But when I tried one in the gravel pit back yonder, it was more like four. You can't trust your Oriental races. Remember that.
Andy said he would.
All right, come on. Let's get your weapon.
Hesitantly, Andy asked,
Are we going to take them out?
Chef looked surprised.
Not unless we have to, no.
Good,
Andy said. In spite of everything, he didn't really want to hurt anyone.
But if they force the issue, we'll do what's necessary. Do you understand that?
Yes,
Andy said. Chef clapped him on the shoulder. 13. Joe asked his mother if Benny and Nori could spend the night. Claire said it was okay with her if it was okay with their parents. It would, in fact, be something of a relief. After their adventure on Black Ridge, she liked the idea of having them under her eye. They could make popcorn on the wood stove and continue the raucous game of Monopoly they'd begun an hour ago. It was too raucous, actually. Their chatter and catcalls had a nervy, whistling past the graveyard quality she didn't care for. Benny's mother agreed, and, somewhat to her surprise, so did Nori's.
Good deal, Joni Calvert said. I've been wanting to get schnockered ever since this happened. Looks like tonight's my chance. And Claire, tell that girl to hunt up her grandfather tomorrow and give him a kiss.
Who's her grandfather?
Ernie, you know Ernie, don't you? Everybody knows Ernie. He worries about her, so do I sometimes. That skateboard.
There was a shudder in Joni's voice.
I'll tell her.
Claire had no more than hung up when there was a knock at the door. At first she didn't know who the middle-aged woman with the pale, strange face was. Then she realized it was Linda Everett, who ordinarily worked the school crossing beat and ticketed cars that overstayed their welcome in the 2-hour parking zones on Main Street. And she wasn't middle-aged at all. She just looked that way now.
Linda, Claire said, what's wrong? Is it Rusty? Has something happened to Rusty?
She was thinking of radiation, at least in the front of her mind. In the back, even worse ideas slithered around.
He's been arrested.
The Monopoly game in the dining room had ceased. The participants now stood together in the living room doorway, gazing at Linda solemnly.
It's a whole laundry list of charges, including criminal complicity in the murders of Lester Coggins and Brenda Perkins.
No!
Benny cried. Claire thought of telling them to leave the room and decided it would be hopeless. She thought she knew why Linda was here and understood it, but still hated her a little for coming. And Rusty, too, for getting the kids involved. Except they were all involved, weren't they? Under the dome, involvement was no longer a matter of choice.
He got in Rennie's way, Linda said. That's what it's really about. That's what it's all about now, as far as Big Jim's concerned. Who's in his way and who isn't? He's forgotten entirely what a terrible situation we're in here. No, it's worse than that. He's using the situation.
Joe looked at Linda solemnly.
Does Mr. Rennie know where we went this morning, Ms. Everett? Does he know about the box?
I don't think he should know about the box.
What box?
The one we found on Black Ridge, Nori said. We only saw the light it puts out. Rusty went right up and looked at it.
It's the generator, Benny said, only he couldn't shut it off. He couldn't even lift it, although he said it was real small.
I don't know anything about this, Linda said.
Then neither does Rennie, Joe said. He looked as if the weight of the world had just slipped off his shoulders.
How do you know?
Because
he would have sent the cops to question us, Joe said. And if we didn't answer the questions, they'd take us to jail.
At a distance, there came a pair of faint reports. Claire cocked her head and frowned.
Were those firecrackers or gunshots?
Linda didn't know, and because they hadn't come from town, they were too faint for that. She didn't care.
Kids, tell me what happened on Black Ridge. Tell me everything. What you saw and what Rusty saw. And later tonight, there's some other people you may have to tell. It's time we put together everything we know. In fact, it's past time.
Claire opened her mouth to say she didn't want to get involved, then didn't. Because there was no choice. None, at least, that she could see. 14. The WCIK studio was set well back from Little Bitch Road, and the driveway leading to it, paved and in far better shape than the road itself, was almost a quarter of a mile long. At the Little Bitch end, it was flanked by a pair of 100-year oaks. Their fall foliage, in a normal season brilliant enough to qualify for a calendar or tourism brochure, now hung limp and brown. Andy Sanders stood behind one of these crenellated trunks. Chef was behind the other. They could hear the approaching diesel roar of big trucks. Sweat ran into Andy's eyes and he wiped it away.
Sanders.
What?
Is your safety off?
Andy checked.
Yes.
All right. Listen. And get it right the first time. If I tell you to start shooting, spray those motherfuckers. Top to bottom, fore and aft. If I don't tell you to shoot, just stand there. Have you got that?
Yes.
I don't think there's going to be any killing.
Thank God, Andy thought.
Not if it's just the Bowies and Mr. Chicken, but I can't be sure. If I do have to make a play, will you back me?
Yes. No hesitation.
And keep your finger off that damn trigger or you're apt to blow your own head off.
Andy looked down, saw his finger was indeed curled around the trigger of the AK, and removed it in a hurry. They waited. Andy could hear his heartbeat in the middle of his head. He told himself it was stupid to be afraid. If not for a fortuitous phone call, he'd already be dead. But it did no good, because a new world had opened in front of him. He knew it might turn out to be a false world. Hadn't he seen what dope had done to Andy Grinnell? But it was better than the shitty world he'd been living in.
God, please let them just go away, he prayed. Please. The trucks appeared, rolling slow and blowing dark smoke into the muted remains of the day. Peeking from behind his tree, Andy could see two men in the lead truck. Probably the Bowies. For a long time, Chef didn't move. Andy was beginning to think he changed his mind and meant to let them take the propane after all. Then Chef stepped out and triggered off two quick rounds. Stoned or not, Chef's aim was good. Both front tires of the lead truck went flat. The front end pogoed up and down three or four times, and then the truck came to a halt. The one behind almost rear-ended it. Andy could hear the faint sound of music, some hymn, and guessed that whoever was driving the second truck hadn't heard the gunshots over the radio. The cab of the lead truck, meanwhile, looked empty. Both men had ducked down out of sight. Chef Bushy, still barefooted and wearing nothing but his ribbit PJs, the garage door opener was hooked over the sagging waistband like a beeper, stepped out from behind his tree.
Stuart Bowie, he called. Fern Bowie, come on out of there and talk to me.
He leaned God's warrior against the oak. Nothing from the cab of the lead truck, but the driver's door of the second truck opened and Roger Killian got out.
What's the holdup? He bawled. I gotta get back and feed my chick.
Then he saw Chef.
Hey there, Philly, what's up?
Get down, one of the Bowies bawled. Crazy son of a bitch is shooting.
Roger looked at Chef, then at the AK-47 leaning against the tree.
Maybe he was, but he's put the gun down. Besides, it's just him. What's the deal, Phil?
I'm Chef now. Call me Chef.
Okay, Chef, what's the deal?
Come on out, Stuart, Chef called. You too, Fern. Nobody's gonna get hurt here, I guess.
The doors of the lead truck opened. Without turning his head, Chef said, Sanders, if either of those two fools has a gun, you open up. Never mind single shot. Turn him into taco cheese. But neither Bowie had a gun. Fern had his hands hoisted.
Who you talking to, buddy? Stuart asked.
Step out here, Sanders, Chef said.
Andy did. Now that the threat of immediate carnage seemed to have passed, he was starting to enjoy himself. If he'd thought to bring one of Chef's fry daddies with him, he was sure he'd be enjoying himself even more.
Andy, Stuart said, astounded, what are you doing here?
I've been drafted into the Lord's army, and you are bitter men. We know all about you, and you have no place here.
Huh?
Fern said. He lowered his hands. The nose of the lead truck was slowly canting toward the road as the big front tires continued to deflate.
Well said, Sanders,
Chef told him. Then to Stuart.
All three of you get in that second truck, turn it around and haul your sorry asses back to town. When you get there, tell that apostate son of the devil the WCIK is ours now. That includes the lab and all the supplies.
What the fuck are you talking about, Phil?
Chef.
Stuart made a flapping gesture with one hand.
Call yourself whatever you want. Just tell me, what is this about?
I know your brother's stupid, Chef said, and Mr. Chicken there probably can't tie his own shoes without a blueprint.
Hey, Roger cried. Watch your mouth.
Andy raised his AK. He thought that when he got a chance, he would paint Claudette on the stock.
No. You watch yours.
Roger Killian went pale and fell back a step. That had never happened when Andy spoke at a town meeting, and it was very gratifying. Chef went on talking as if there had been no interruption.
But you've got at least half a brain, Stuart, so use it. Leave that truck setting right where it is and go back to town and tell the one. Tell Rennie this out here doesn't belong to him anymore. It belongs to God. Tell him Star Wormwood has blazed, and if he doesn't want the apocalypse to come early, he better leave us alone.
He considered.
You can also tell him we'll keep putting out the music. I doubt he's worried about that, but there's some in town might find it a comfort.
Do you know how many cops he's got now?
Stuart asked.
I don't give a tin shit.
I think about 30. But tomorrow it's apt to be 50, and half the damn town's wearing blue support armbands. If he tells them to posse up, it won't be no trouble.
It won't be no help either. Chef said, our faith is in the Lord and our strength is that of 10.
Well, Rogers said, flashing his math skills. That's 20, but you're still outnumbered.
Shut up, Roger, Fern said.
Stuart tried again.
Hill.
Chef, I mean, you need to chill the fuck out. Because this ain't no thang. He don't want the dope, just the propane. Half the Jennies in town are out. By the weekend, it'll be 3/4. Let us take the propane.
I need it to cook with. Sorry.
Stuart looked at him as if he had gone mad. He probably has, Andy thought. We probably both have. But of course, Jim Rennie was mad too, so that was a wash.
Go on now, Chef said, and tell him that if he tries sending troops against us, he will regret it.
Stuart thought this over, then shrugged.
No skin off my rosy red chinchina. Come on, Fern. Roger, I'll drive.
Fine by me, Roger Killian said. I hate all them gears.
He gave Chef and Andy a final look rich with mistrust, then started back to the second truck.
God bless you, fellas, Andy called.
Stuart threw a sour dart of a glance back over his shoulder.
God bless you, too, because God knows you're going to need it.
The new proprietors of the largest meth lab in North America stood side by side, watching the big orange truck back down the road, make a clumsy K-turn, and drive away.
Sanders.
Yes, Chef.
I want to pep up the music, and immediately. This town needs some Mavis Staples. Also some Clark Sisters. Once I get that shit queued up, let's smoke.
Andy's eyes filled with tears. He put his arm around the former Phil Bushy's bony shoulders and hugged.
I love you, Chef.
Thanks, Sanders. Right back at you. Just keep your gun loaded. From now on, we'll have to stand watches.
15. Big Jim was sitting at his son's bedside as approaching sunset turned the day orange. Douglas Twitchell had come in to give Junior a shot. Now the boy was deeply asleep. In some ways, Big Jim knew, it would be better if Junior died. Alive and with a tumor pressing down on his brain, there was no telling what he might do or say. Of course, the kid was his own flesh and blood, but there was the greater good to think about. The good of the town. One of the extra pillows in the closet would probably do it. That was when his phone rang. He looked at the name in the window and frowned. Something had gone wrong. Stuart would hardly be calling so soon if it were otherwise.
What?
He listened with growing astonishment. Andy? Out there? Andy with a gun? Stuart was waiting for him to answer, waiting to be told what to do. Get in line, pal, Big Jim thought, and sighed.
Give me a minute, I need to think.
I'll call you back.
He ended the call and considered this new problem. He could take a bunch of cops out there tonight. In some ways, it was an attractive idea. Whip them up at Food City, then lead the raid himself. If Andy died, so much the better. That would make James Rennie Sr. the entire town government. On the other hand, the special town meeting was tomorrow night. Everyone would come, and there would be questions. He was sure he could lay the meth lab off on Barbara and the friends of Barbara. In Big Jim's mind, Andy Sanders had now become an official friend of Barbara. But still, no. No. He wanted his flock scared, but not in an outright panic. Panic wouldn't serve his purpose, which was to establish complete control of the town. And if he let Andy and Bushy stay where they were for a little while, what harm? It might even do some good. They'd grow complacent. They might fancy themselves forgotten, because drugs were full of vitamin stupid. Friday, on the other hand, the day after tomorrow, was that cotton picker Cox's designated visitor's day. Everybody would stream out to the Dinsmore farm again. Burpee would no doubt set up another hot dog stand. While that cluster mug was going on, and while Cox was conducting his one-man press conference, Big Jim himself could lead a force of 16 or 18 police up to the radio station and wipe those two troublesome stoners out. Yes. That was the answer. He called Stuart back and told him to leave well enough alone.
But I thought you wanted the propane, Stuart said.
We'll get it, Big Jim said, and you can help us take care of those two if you want to.
You're damn right I want to. That son of a bitch... Sorry, Big Jim. That son of a buck Bushy needs a payback.
He'll get it. Friday afternoon. Clear his schedule.
Big Jim felt fine again. Heart beating slowly and steadily in his chest. Nary a stutter or flutter. And that was good, because there was so much to do, starting with tonight's police pep talk at Food City. Just the right environment in which to impress the importance of order on a bunch of new cops. Really, there was nothing like a scene of destruction to get people playing follow the leader. He started out of the room, then went back and kissed his sleeping son's cheek. Getting rid of Junior might become necessary, but for the time being, that too could wait.
16.
Another night is falling on the little town of Chester's Mill. Another night under the dome. But there is no rest for us. We have two meetings to attend, and we also ought to check up on Horace the Corgi before we sleep. Horace is keeping Andrea Grinnell company tonight, and although he is for the moment biding his time, he has not forgotten the popcorn between the couch and the wall. So let us go then, you and I, while the evening spreads out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go while the first discolored stars begin to show overhead. This is the only town in a four-state area where they're out tonight. Rain has overspread northern New England, and cable news viewers will soon be treated to some remarkable satellite photographs showing a hole in the clouds that exactly mimics the sock shape of Chester's Mill. Here the stars shine down, but now they're dirty stars, because the dome is dirty. Heavy showers fall in Tarker's Mills, and the part of Castle Rock known as The View. CNN's meteorologist, Reynolds Wolfe, no relation to Rose Twitchell's Wolfie, says that while no one can as yet be entirely sure, it seems likely that the west-to-east airflow is pushing the clouds against the western side of the dome and squeezing them like sponges before they can slide away to the north and south. He calls it a fascinating phenomenon. Suzanne Malveaux, the anchor, asks him what the long-term weather under the dome might be like if the crisis continues.
Suzanne, Reynolds Wolfe says, that's a great question. All we know for sure is that Chester's Mill isn't getting any rain tonight, although the surface of the dome is permeable enough so that some moisture may be seeping through where the showers are heaviest. NOAA meteorologists tell me the long-term prospects of precip under the dome aren't good. And we know their principal waterway, Presteel Stream, has pretty much dried up.
He smiles, showing a great set of TV teeth.
Thank God for artesian wells.
You bet, Reynolds, Suzanne says. And then the Geico gecko appears on the TV screens of America. That's enough cable news. Let us float through certain half-deserted streets, past the Congo Church and the parsonage. The meeting there hasn't started yet, but Piper has loaded up the big coffee urn, and Julia is making sandwiches by the light of a hissing Coleman lamp. Past the McCain house surrounded by its sad sag of yellow police tape. Downtown Common Hill and past the town hall, where Janitor Al Timmons and a couple of his friends are cleaning and sprucing up for the special town meeting tomorrow night. Past War Memorial Plaza, where the statue of Lucian Calvert, Norrie's great-grandfather, I probably don't have to tell you that, keeps his long watch. We'll stop for a quick check on Barbie and Rusty, shall we? There'll be no problem getting downstairs. There are only three cops in the ready room, and Stacy Moggin, who's on the desk, is sleeping with her head pillowed on her forearm. The rest of the PD is at Food City, listening to Big Jim's latest stem winder, but it wouldn't matter if they were all here because we are invisible. They would feel no more than a faint draft as we glide past them. There's not much to see in the coop, because Hope is as invisible as we are. The two men have nothing to do but wait until tomorrow night, and hope that things break their way. Rusty's hand hurts, but the pain isn't as bad as he thought it might be, and the swelling isn't as bad as he feared. Also, Stacy Moggin, God bless her heart, snuck him a couple of Excedrin around 5 p.m. For the time being, these two men, our heroes, I suppose, are sitting on their bunks and playing 20 questions. It's Rusty's turn to guess.
Animal, vegetable, or mineral? He asks.
None of them, Barbie replies.
How can it be none of them? It has to be one.
It's not, Barbie says. He is thinking of Papa Smurf.
You're jacking me up.
I'm not.
You have to be.
Quit bitching and start asking.
Can I have a hint?
No, that's your first no, 19 to go.
Wait a goddamn minute, that's not fair. We'll leave them to shift the weight of the next 24 hours as best they can, shall we? Let us make our way past the still-simmering heap of ashes that used to be the Democrat. Alas, no longer serving the little town that looks like a boot. Past Sanders' hometown drug. Scorched, but still standing. Although Andy Sanders will never pass through its doors again. Past the bookstore and Leclerc's Maison des Fleurs, where all the fleurs are now dead or dying. Let us pass under the dead stoplight marking the intersection of routes 119 and 117. We brush it. It sways slightly. Then stills again. And cross the Food City parking lot. We are as silent as a child's sleeping breath. The supermarket's big front windows have been covered with plywood requisitioned from Tabby Morell's lumberyard. And the worst of the gluck on the floor has been mopped up by Jack Cale and Ernie Calvert. But Food City is still a god-awful mess, with boxes and dry goods strewn from hell to breakfast. The remaining merchandise, what hasn't been carted away to various town pantries or stored in the motor pool behind the PD, in other words, is scattered helter-skelter on the shelves. The soft drink cooler, beer cooler, and ice cream freezer are busted in. There's the high stink of spilled wine. This leftover chaos is exactly what Big Jim Rennie wants his new, and awfully young for the most part, cadre of enforcement officers to see. He wants them to realize the whole town could look like this. And he's canny enough to know he doesn't need to say it right out loud. They will get the point. This is what happens when the shepherd fails in his duty and the flock stampedes. Do we need to listen to his speech? Nah. We'll be listening to Big Jim tomorrow night, and that should be enough. Besides, we all know how this one goes. America's two great specialties are demagogues and rock and roll, and we've all heard plenty of both in our time. Yet, we should examine the faces of his listeners before we go. Notice how rapt they are. And then remind yourself that many of these, Carter Thibodeau, Mickey Wardlaw, and Todd Wendell Stett, to name just three, are chumps who couldn't get through a single week of school without scoring detention for causing trouble in class or fighting in the bathrooms. But Rennie has them hypnotized. He's never been much of a shake one-on-one, but when he's in front of a crowd, rowdy-dow and hot-cha-cha, as old Clayton Brassey used to say back in the days when he still had a few working brain cells. Big Jim's telling them, thin blue line, and the pride of standing with your fellow officers, and the town is depending on you. Other stuff, too. The good stuff that never loses its charm. Big Jim switches to Barbie. He tells them that Barbie's friends are still out there, sowing discord and fomenting dissension for their own evil purposes. Lowering his voice, he says, they'll try to discredit me. The lies they'll tell have no bottom. A growl of displeasure greets this. Will you listen to lies? Will you let them discredit me? Will you allow this town to go without a strong leader in its time of greatest need? The answer, of course, is a resounding no. And although Big Jim continues, like most politicians, he believes in not just gilding the lily but spray painting it, we can leave him now. Let's head up these deserted streets to the Congo Parsonage. And look, here's someone we can walk with. A 13-year-old girl dressed in faded jeans and an old-school Winged Ripper skateboard tee. The tough riot girl pout, that is her mother's despair, is gone from Nori Calvert's face this evening. It has been replaced by an expression of wonder that makes her look like the 8-year-old she not so long ago was. We follow her gaze and see a vast full moon climbing from the clouds to the east of town. It is the color and shape of a freshly cut pink grapefruit.
Oh, my God,
Nori whispers. One fisted hand is pressed between the scant nubs of her breasts as she looks at that pink freak of a moon. Then she walks on, not so amazed that she fails to look around herself from time to time to make sure she's not being noticed. This is as per Linda Everett's order. They were to go alone, they were to be unobtrusive, and they were to make absolutely sure they weren't followed. This isn't a game, Linda told them. Nori was more impressed by her pale, strained face than by her words. If we get caught, they won't just take away hit points or make us miss a turn. Do you kids understand that? Can I go with Joe? Mrs. McClatchy asked. She was almost as pale as Mrs. Everett. Mrs. Everett shook her head. Bad idea. And that had impressed Nori most of all. No, not a game. Maybe life and death.
Ah, but there is the church. And the parsonage, tucked in right beside it. Nori can see the bright white light of Coleman lanterns around back, where the kitchen must be. Soon she'll be inside. Out from under the gaze of that awful pink moon. Soon she'll be safe. So she's thinking when a shadow detaches itself from one of the thicker shadows and takes her by the arm. 17. Nori was too startled to scream, which was just as well. When the pink moon lit the face of the man who had accosted her, she saw it was Romeo Burpee.
You scared the crap out of me, she whispered.
Sorry, just keeping an eye out, me.
Romy let go of her arm and looked around.
Where are your boyfriends?
Nori smiled at that.
Dunno. We were supposed to come by ourselves in different ways. That's what Mrs. Everett said.
She looked down the hill.
I think that's Joey's mom coming now. We should go in.
They walked toward the light of the lanterns. The parsonage's inner door was standing open. Romy knocked softly on the side of the screen and said,
Romy Burpee and a friend. If there's a password, we didn't get it.
Piper Libby opened the door and let them in. She looked curiously at Nori.
Who are you?
Damn if that isn't my granddaughter,
Ernie said, coming into the room. He had a glass of lemonade in one hand and a grin on his face.
Come here, girl, I've been missing you.
Nori gave him a strong hug and kissed him as her mother had instructed. She hadn't expected to obey those instructions so soon, but was glad to do so. And to him, she could tell the truth that torture would not have dragged from her lips in front of the guy she hung with.
Grandpa, I'm so scared.
We all are, honey girl.
He hugged her more tightly, then looked into her upturned face.
I don't know what you're doing here, but now that you are, how about a glass of lemonade?
Nori saw the urn and said,
I'd rather have coffee. So would I, Piper said. I got it all loaded with high test and ready to go before I remembered I have no power.
She gave her head a little shake as if to clear it.
This keeps hitting me in different ways.
There was another knock at the back door and Lissa Jameson came in, her cheeks high with color.
I stashed my bike in your garage, Reverend Libby. I hope that's okay.
Fine. And if we're engaging in criminal conspiracy here, as Rennie and Randolph would no doubt contend, you better call me Piper.
18. They were all early, and Piper called the Chester's Mill Revolutionary Committee to order at just past 9 o'clock. What impressed her initially was how uneven the sexual division was. 8 females, and only 4 males. And of the 4 males, one was past retirement age, and 2 weren't old enough to get into an R-rated movie by themselves. She had to remind herself that 100 guerrilla armies in various parts of the world had put guns in the hands of women and kids no older than these here tonight. That didn't make it right, but sometimes what was right and what was necessary came into conflict.
I'd like us to bow our heads for a minute, Piper said. I'm not going to pray because I'm no longer sure just who I'm talking to when I do that. But you might want to say a word to the God of your understanding, because tonight we need all the help we can get.
They did as she asked. Some still had their heads down and their eyes closed when Piper raised her own head to look at them. 2 recently fired lady cops. A retired supermarket manager. A newspaper woman who no longer had a newspaper. A librarian. The owner of the local restaurant. A dome widow who couldn't stop spinning the wedding ring on her finger. The local department store tycoon. And 3 uncharacteristically solemn-faced kids sitting scrunched together on the sofa.
Okay. Amen, Piper said. I'm going to turn the meeting over to Jackie Weddington, who knows what she's doing.
That's probably too optimistic, Jackie said. Not to mention hasty, because I'm going to turn the meeting over to Joe McClatchy.
Joe looked startled.
Me?
But before he gets going, she went on, I'm going to ask his friends to serve as lookouts, Nori in front and Benny in back. Jackie saw the protest on their faces and raised a hand to forestall it. This isn't an excuse to get you out of the room. It's important. I don't need to tell you it might not be good if the powers that be caught us in conclave. You 2 are the smallest. Find some nice deep shadows and slide in. If you see someone coming who looks suspicious or any of the town police cars, clap your hands, like this. She clapped once, then twice. Then once more.
You'll be filled in on everything later, I promise you. The new order of the day is pooled information, no secrets. When they were gone, Jackie turned to Joe. This box you told Linda about, tell everyone. From beginning to end. Joe did it on his feet, as if reciting in school.
Then we came back to town, he finished, and that bastard Rennie had Rusty arrested.
He wiped sweat from his forehead and sank back down on the couch. Claire put an arm around his shoulders. Joe says it would be bad for Rennie to find out about the box, she said. He thinks Rennie might want it to keep on doing what it's doing, instead of trying to turn it off or destroy it. I think he's right, Jackie said. So its existence and location is our first secret.
I don't know, Joe said.
What? Julia asked. You think he should know?
Maybe. Sort of. I need to think.
Jackie pushed on without questioning him further. Here's the second order of business. I want to try and break Barbie and Rusty out of jail. Tomorrow night, during the big town meeting. Barbie's the guy the president designated to take over the town administration.
Anybody but Rennie, Ernie growled. Incompetent son of a bitch thinks he owns this burg.
He's good at one thing, Linda said, stirring up trouble when it suits him. The food riot and the newspaper being burned, I think both of those were done according to his orders. Of course they were, Jackie said. Anyone who could kill his own pastor. Rose goggled at her.
Are you saying Rennie killed Coggins?
Jackie told him about the basement workroom in the funeral parlor, and how the marks on Coggins' face matched the gold baseball Rusty had seen in Rennie's study. They listened with dismay, but no disbelief.
The girls, too?
Lissa Jameson said in a small, horrified voice. I've got his son down for that. Jackie spoke almost briskly. And those murders were probably not related to Big Jim's political machinations. Junior collapsed this morning. At the McCain house, incidentally, where the bodies were found. By him.
What a coincidence, Ernie said.
He's in the hospital. Ginny Tomlinson says it's almost certainly a brain tumor, which can cause violent behavior.
A father-son murder team.
Claire was hugging Joe more tightly than ever. Not a team, exactly, Jackie said. Call it the same wild strain of behavior, something genetic, coming out under pressure. Linda said, but the bodies being in the same place strongly suggests that if there were two murderers, they were working together. The point is, my husband and Dale Barbara are almost certainly being held by a killer who's using them to build a grand conspiracy theory. The only reason they haven't already been killed in custody is because Rennie wants to make an example of them. He wants them executed in public. Her face cramped for a moment as she fought off tears.
I can't believe he's gotten as far as he has, Alyssa said.
She was twisting the ankh she wore back and forth.
He's a used car dealer, for heaven's sake.
Silence greeted this. Now look, Jackie said after it had stretched out a bit. By telling you what Linda and I mean to do, I've made this a real conspiracy. I'm going to ask for a vote. If you want to be a part of this, raise your hand. Those who don't raise their hands can leave, contingent on a promise not to blab about what we've discussed, which you wouldn't want to do anyway. If you don't tell anybody who was here and what was discussed, you won't have to explain how you heard. This is dangerous. We might end up in jail or even worse. So let's see some hands. Who wants to stay? Joe raised his hand first. But Piper, Julia, Rose, and Ernie Calvert were not far behind. Linda and Romy raised their hands together. Lissa looked at Claire McClatchy. Claire sighed and nodded. The two women raised their hands.
Way to go, Mom. Joe said.
If you ever tell your father what I let you get into, she said, you won't need James Rennie to execute you. I'll do it myself. 19.
Linda can't go into the PD after them, Romy said.
He was speaking to Jackie.
Who then?
You and me, hon. Linda's gonna go to the big meeting, where 600 or 800 people can testify that they saw her.
Why can't I go? Linda asked. That's my husband they've got. That's why, Julia said simply.
How do you want to do it? Romy asked Jackie.
Well, I suggest we wear masks.
Duh, Rose said, and made a face.
They all laughed.
Lucky us, Romy said. I got a great selection of Halloween